Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Inatec.
No, you're working at Inatec because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world, and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
If I had a million.
Going all thanks, Dr. Jackson. I'm talking about Andrew on the board. We're finally here. Still kind of weather issues, but should be okay from now on, at least until the next snowstorm. SP futures up 20, NASDAQ futures up 131. We're all happy. Government's getting back together. At least that's the. They should string this out another few more days, a few more rallies, just because we're anticipating government getting back together, even though when they're back together, we don't think they're doing much, but that's what we're doing. Do we have Professor Kevin?
Yeah, but I've been called back to government duty, so, you may not have me very long.
I hear your place is, you were visited by the president, and since he allowed you to exist, you're being named Trump University.
There was a Trump University. That's out of business.
Yeah, they scammed everybody, didn't they? What was the deal with those guys?
It was them and a lot of other of the not of the for-profit educational institutions, and the problem that everybody had was, there's a number of them. One is getting accreditation, so getting the credibility for helping people get jobs and so on is a big deal. And of course, that's a tightly run cartel, so it isn't really easy for a for-profit institution. I'm trying to think, what's the one that's in Arizona?
Was it Phoenix? It wasn't Phoenix. It was, wasn't it? Phoenix is a real school. Well, actually, there was a Phoenix that was a real school, and Phoenix it wasn't, right?
Yeah, there's the one they play Division I basketball too. So I'm trying to remember the name of the college, but it might be University of Phoenix. I'm not sure. So there are some success stories there, but by and large, the faculty, how you credential faculty, having a really good philosophy of how you approach education, having good professional training, even because everybody was an adjunct professor, having professional training, all of that kind of stuff for the instructors didn't exist. And just to give you a silly example, I teach a class in that's it's a lean class, basically. It's a quality management class, and it's built around lean. And the students have an opportunity to earn a yellow belt, which is the first level, lean certification. And one of the things that I put into the class, it's not really even necessarily part of the statewide, template for it. But one of the things I put into the class is a whole section on learning theory, how adults learn, different learning styles and so on, because if you're going to write standard operating procedures, then you better have a pretty good idea about how adults learn. You better have an idea of how to accommodate people who might not be as skilled in English, especially written English, because you get a lot of Spanish-speaking people who they learn to speak conversational English, but they never really learn to read English. So you have to have procedures that accommodate that. And then you have
to... Sounds like most of the schools now.
Pardon?
Sounds like most of the schools now.
Well, yeah, but if you can't read in college, you're probably not, I mean, I can accommodate it only so far.
Yeah.
And I've had the opposite, by the way. I once had a student who read English beautifully. She just didn't speak it. She was sort of like, did you take Latin in high school?
4 years, God.
Okay, so did I. You know,
why? Because you were horrible at everything else, like I was, or what?
Well, no, it was actually interesting because we got to read a lot of, you know, the classic poetry of the Roman Empire days, and classic short stories and longer stories. We got to read all those in native language. So, from that standpoint, it was really enriching. But were you ever going to be able to have a conversation with somebody in Latin if anybody spoke it?
I'm not sure anybody ever spoke the real Latin, did they?
Well, my point being, you know, I have someone who, I had a student who was raised in Mexico. She lived, you know, her family lived in Mexico City before they came to the United States. She learned English very much the same way you and I learned Latin. Is you learn to read it, you learn the grammar structures and all of that. But she had no confidence whatsoever in her ability to speak English well. And so, you know, that was a little bit of a challenge in the classroom to be able to draw her out and get her to participate. But the kind of funny story, you know, the work she submitted, her homework that she submitted was just beautifully done. She was a, you know, really smart young woman. And she was taking business law, and I had a judge from the Indiana court system who was teaching business law for me, and he called me up one day and he said, "She's submitting this work. I think she's plagiarizing." And I said, "No, actually, that's her. That's her."
Well, most people can get the. I mean, if you or I were to learn German, we probably could learn the written part or read a lot quicker than we could speak. Because it's your speed, you go your own speed when you're reading.
In the language all day, every day, was like, we learned a little bit about that yesterday. But nevertheless, yeah, my point being that in Cynthia's case, she was really smart and she was really adept at written English. And I knew that because I had worked through a couple of classes with her. But when Judge Bowers called me up, he didn't know that because he only knew her from the classroom. At that point, where she had a hard time speaking up, and so that that's the anecdotal part of that. So anyway, back to the point about putting in something about adult learning and how that's different from how children learn, and then different learning styles. Some people are tactile, and some people are they want to read, and some people want video, and some people and there's even a music. Remember the Dirty Dozen? How they counted down the all the steps they take.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not music per se, but that's a musical learner type of thing. And so, you're not going to get that kind of material for people who have to write procedures for people on the production line. You're not going to get that kind of material in some of the for-profit schools. They just don't have
the
faculty development to be able to deliver that. And so I think that makes a difference too.
Well, the whole when that thing was all happening, and again, I don't know if Trump's school was put together with a lick and a promise. I'm going to say it probably wasn't. It probably had some stuff going for it. God, Kevin, we can go off on any topic we want, and it always comes back to me to be the same goddamn subject. Look what happened to those places. What exactly is a profit school? If I walked into one of your business classes or Russell's, the first thing I would do is screw everybody up. I'd walk up on the blackboard showing my age and say, "Define for me the word profit." What in God's name does it mean anymore?
I guess it depends on the venue, and even at that, when we look at we talk about stock price valuations, what does it mean to them anyway? So.
Well, yeah, you've got that, and if you walk into one of my favorite whipping boys is, say, Commonwealth Edison, or even, the University of Illinois College, or whatever, the Board of Trustees. If I walk in and I were to say, this is supposedly a non-profit, suppose I were to say, guys, here's my list of what a controller makes, what a CEO, a vice president of finance makes, across the board in countries this size, and say it's $1 million a year, and all of a sudden everybody at Commonwealth Edison's making $4 million a year. Well, I don't know why that's not considered profit. It's just not going to the owners. I mean,
I agree with you, Tom. I agree with you on that. I think that's an important point. But anyway, if you go back to the Obama administration, you know that they worked really hard against a lot of these for-profit schools. Brown Mackey is one that comes to mind, that was locally that wound up going out of business, and there were a number of those. And you know, I think some of that, a fair amount of that, was because it was protection for the status quo.
Without a doubt.
Because it wasn't like they couldn't work, and it probably wasn't that none of them were delivering a quality product. But there was an all-out assault on that. And how Trump University figured into that, I don't know, because I really paid very little attention to Trump University at the time. But was it a swindle or was it just a poorly executed product? I don't know.
Well, the whole point is, when you're going after somebody with the profit mantra. Now, profit to a lot of people is a dirty word. That the world can't really go around without profit, right? Because why would anybody do anything? That's our system.
Oh, I'll take it further, and I'll come back to that in a second.
Well, I'm saying, so the idea that you're having a profit university, what is Notre Dame's story? What do they promise people? You graduate out of there and you don't get a job, you can't sue them. Why all of a sudden? We actually had a lady who worked for us, boy, that's a long time ago. This had to be before the Obama administration. And I think her name was Maggie. That was a long time. And she was working here. She was very nice. And never didn't show up, blah, blah, blah. And she took one of these night for-profit nursing things. She wanted to be a nurse. And she went through the whole routine. And it cost her a bunch of dough. And, of course, they gave her a loan. You know, the usual crap that came up with these places. I mean, they were intertwined with the loan people and so forth. And all of a sudden, she, I think, graduated, but couldn't get a nursing residence anywhere. Okay, well, guess who runs the nursing residences? The hospitals. And guess who have their own nursing places, in a lot of ways? The hospitals.
Hospitals, yeah.
So, I mean, if you read, like, the first page of the Clayton Act, those are the people that should have gone to jail. Not to say the other people should have. Their loans and stuff might have been crooked. I don't know that much about it. But those are the people who should have been indicted. For not letting anybody in except your own school.
And honestly, Tom, I think that back when all of this had flared up and there were a bunch of these situations, probably the worst sin committed was the promise of a career that couldn't be delivered. And whether that was for exactly what you described, is that program was just not going to get recognized enough for the people to get hired. Or for whatever other reason, that was what blew it up more than anything else. But the problem is exactly what you said: there were loans due, there were other obligations due, and there wasn't an income that offset that made it worth the trouble.
They put it out there sort of as a business model, but Andrew, I don't want to put you on the spot, bud, but. Andrew's degree is in creative design. How hot is that field, Andrew? I don't know if he's listening. But he's struggling to find a job in his field. Now, does the place owe him something? I don't know. What if you went to Notre Dame in government and all of a sudden you can't find a job as a guy who works for an Illinois state senator? Would they owe you something? I mean, I don't know. I mean, what are they promising? I mean, what...
What if you majored in women's studies or something like that?
We're all studying women, aren't we?
I think it's incumbent on the student as a consumer to understand what the job market is for people with those credentials, and I think for them it is really important to know what you're getting into. We have a lot of people at our place that major in the human services group. There are jobs available in there. They're not going to pay very well. Whereas people with industry credentials are going to do well. Our business students, we're not going to place a ton of business students with associate's degrees. We encourage them, take your 2-year associates with us, but then keep going and get your bachelor's degree because you're going to need that. Um, you know, that's the degree that's going to get recognition in the business world more than anything else. Whereas, you know, my supply chain students, their recognition is probably in the industry certifications that they earn more than anything else. And they don't until they get to the point of wanting to be a plant manager or a VP of operations, they're not going to need a bachelor's degree. So it's going to vary from, you know, from market to market. And I think it's incumbent, you know, yes, it's important for the schools to represent that properly, but it's really incumbent on the students.
But I would think that if somebody had the crap beat out of him for 4 years at Notre Dame in aerospace engineering and came out the same year that Boeing took over Lockheed or something, or McDonnell Douglas, and everybody got fired, it was a horrible year, Notre Dame would say they don't owe you anything, and yet they made one hell of a profit, and by the way, you got some big fat loans sitting there. I mean, how do they weasel out of it? These other guys didn't, I guess, my question.
Well, yeah. They didn't. I guess it was just a matter of, you know, when we talk case by case, that's one thing. When we talk about the overall trend, you know, that might paint a different picture.
Hey, I got a couple of, speaking of which, I don't know what we got on this subject because I just dug up, I sent you, I don't know if you had a chance to look at it, you know, all kinds of stuff to talk about. I was on Joel's show yesterday, and the topic came up of the numbers that came out. Am I being it? Didn't the CPI come out? And I'll read today saying that all these reports didn't come out. The CPI came out, didn't it?
Yeah, I thought it did.
Yeah.
I remember the CPI coming out.
I thought it did, too, because I remember saying, why is one part of labor statistics working and not the other? Anyway, I don't know if I sent you this. The thing that got me on this topic is there I was, minding my own business last week with nothing on the TV except Memphis is playing, not Memphis State anymore, Memphis is playing Tulane. And of course, my wacky buddy at the bar is betting his ass off on this game, and I'm going, who the hell cares about this? But anyway, but I guess Memphis was 25th until they lost. The guy said it once or twice. I didn't believe him until he said it the third time. Memphis has 78 new players, and the quarterback's in his sixth year. I'm going, what in God's name am I watching here? Every guy is on like his third school, it seemed. What do you do with the other guys? You had to have other people on scholarship. Do you just kick them out? Is there some? One of the guys was saying there's some kind of thing now where you can boot them off the team and not count them as a player as long as you paid her tuition.
Well, I think I mentioned that to you when we discussed it. I really haven't had time to look into the Memphis situation in depth, so I'll take a look at that.
But it seems like a lot, 78, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, it does, and, you know, 78 might be an exaggeration, or it might be the...
That's why the guy said it four times before I believed him. I mean, I don't know how I even do that.
3 years, is it 78 1 year, you know, I got a lot of questions about that before I really buy
Well, the coach has been there, I think it's his second year, I'm not positive on that, so... Maybe it's over 2 years.
But I do know there is some kind of transition thing where you can push people off a new coach. It's like a 1 year part of it where you can push people off the roster, and as long as you maintain the scholarship, you can do that. You know, again, I think that's pretty unseemly for a college. And essentially, what you're telling the guy at that point is that you should leave.
Well, just in terms of logistics, you're the guy who's got me all over this logistics stuff. I blame you. In terms of logistics, I get hired as a new coach in January. I really don't know what I have. I guess I can go back and look at the films and so forth. Avoid films.
That's one of my favorites. Films or tapes? Yes.
Yeah. I can look at what they did before, but
every single sports creature on media, on, you know, whoever's talking about, they always talk about the tape or the film.
Yeah.
And it, you know, I sit there going, it's been decades since we used tape and film.
you're looking at something on what resembles
looking
a tape.
The video.
You're looking at the video. Okay, so I can't have the equivalent of like a mini camp to see what I have, can I? I just have to look at whatever. I mean, how do I even know my guys are no good? I mean, or good? Or,
you have a treasure trove of video.
Yeah, I mean, so I sit there and I look at all that.
The previous year.
All right, so I just got hired as a coach of a team, and I look at all these guys suck. I want to get rid of all of them. Okay, so How do I open up the portal with a new staff and everything and make sure I get 75 guys in the portal? Well, I don't have the video, or maybe I do, or maybe I don't. You can bring some guys with you, maybe, but how do I find 75 new guys I think are better than the 75 guys I have? I don't even know how I'd go about that project.
That's a good question, and I don't know how I'd go about turning it over either. And if I relate it back to what I've done when I've gone into places as the new department head, and they're underperforming terribly. I've never gone in with the idea that I'm just going to clean everybody out of here and start new. I always wanted to go in and see what I had, see what I had, because you wind up finding out, and I'm sure this is true of a football team as well, but I wound up finding in a professional setting that if you had bad management before, you had people working there who had a real thirst for good management, for good leadership, and would respond to it. So I didn't want to go just say, you leave. I got new people coming in. I wanted to see who wanted to get on board. And that could take a little while, to really size up everything. But it was worth it because, you develop a real loyalty and a real camaraderie around that for all the people who are sort of survived the old days and got into the new program. And I just found that to be very powerful when it really came to team building. Honoring legacy, because there is nobody who is like all very few people who are just all bad at their jobs, all bad. I've replaced some people who were all bad at their jobs, but most employees, especially if you're talking about professional, like an IT group or somebody like that, most of them want to do really good work. They just need the leadership to be able to pull it off. And so I would not, going into a football team, you've got people who put a lot of time, over their lifetimes, not just, since signing on at the university. There's a lot of people who put a lot of time into it, and I want to see who those people are, because they're the ones that can be a really strong foundation for your program.
My stepfather ran he was a controller and became a VP of finance of a couple of places. He used to say, when he was younger, he ran accounting departments basically, and he said, if you want to get somebody really good, you got to go to a firm who's kind of struggling, because there's going to be no waste there. And every dollar means something. So you can, if a firm's got, if you fall out of bed and into a pile of money, because I guarantee your accounting department is pretty sloppy, because they can be, which is interesting.
Yeah, I've seen that enough times. And Walter was right. he was absolutely right. As soon as, when the good times are rolling, it's real easy to get sloppy.
What do you make of this college? CNBC's been doing this for a while here, and we went through the football teams. NFL, but also is the most 75 most valuable college athletic programs. And they actually have a revenue in here, Kevin, which is kind of surprising. You always said the revenue is a kind of a fictional number.
It depends on the source. It depends on the source that they use. So if they use the Title IX reporting, it's not a required data element. It's there as an FYI, and a lot of schools treat it that way. The example I've always used is the one time I went and we went through back in Notre Dame's Big East days. I went through all the Big East basketball schools, and sure enough, about half of them had revenue that was exactly to the dollar equal to their expenses. Which just told me, they said, just fill that in with it.
Well, that's the thing. These guys here, this list, we talked about the NFL teams. There was a revenue, and then there was a net that somebody estimated, although the Bears' net was low, and I think that has to do with them paying all the family members. But that's just a suspicion.
Yeah, that could be. The other piece of it for the colleges is that some things that are on the books for some colleges are off the books for others. So it could be, certain media rights, like radio rights and things like that, how they handle some of the coaches' income relative to apparel deals, apparel and shoe deals, or how they handle some of the coaches' income relative to their, you know, like their coaches' shows and things like that. Sometimes that runs through the university's budget. Sometimes that doesn't. Sometimes that's totally off books or in a separate entity, and they, you know, and they just take it all into one bucket and then distribute it among coaches, maybe a head coach and assistant coaches, things like that. There's all kinds of accounting differences, and that makes it difficult to compare as well.
Well, the comparisons they have here, and like you mentioned, I wonder if the revenue numbers are kind of, but just to say what they're throwing at you, the revenue is roughly 40% of a pro team, it looks like, these big teams. Didn't we have like the Bears and those guys at like $750 million or something in the revenue, and the earnings were like 200 or 150 or something. I think that's where we were on the pros. These guys, now they got Ohio State number one, valuation $1.32 billion, revenue $280 million. Got Texas, University of Texas, $1.28 billion valuation, revenue $271 million. Texas A&M actually got the revenue a little higher, $279 million. Didn't we talk a couple of years ago that Texas revenue was way higher than anybody's? But again, it's, you know, you're talking about the sources. Then we've got Alabama fourth at $975 million with $200 million profit. Notre Dame, they've got them making $224 million and $969 million revenue. Then there's Georgia, Nebraska. I'm surprised Nebraska's up there. I would have guessed they weren't that high, but they are. Yeah, they're 940 in the
that
revenue.
That actually doesn't surprise me. That state is very, very tapped into the school itself. Even though it's been a long time since they were really a contender, really, you go to a Nebraska game sometime, you'll know.
But these revenue numbers or the evaluation numbers, well, even the revenue numbers are really close. Notre Dame's 224, Georgia's 210, Nebraska's 205, Tennessee's 202. Oklahoma's 199, Penn State's 202. I mean, they even got the Southern California revenue. They've got them at 212, and yet they're 12th, which is kind of surprising. They're not 12th in revenue. Then there's LSU 200, all kind of right about the same number, which is a little weird. But I think it's probably
You're going to see a lot of similarities among schools in the same conference for sure, because yeah. You know, one of their big sources is media, and they all share the same media amounts, less their own local radio and things like that, but otherwise, a lot of their media distributions are exactly the same.
Well, Wisconsin's 198 in the revenue, Clemson's 196. Then there's a real drop here from 16 to 17, which is kind of interesting. Once you, and I don't see, but now that's what's weird, Kevin. You would think that the people in the Big Ten would be somewhat even. Well, not really, because those guys are the ones that have the biggest stadiums, right? Wisconsin.
Now you start into, okay, yeah, how many tickets do I sell, and do I sell it out every week or come close to sell out every week? And so there's a revenue item there. Licensing is a big deal. So I don't know if licensing is on book or off book, but licensed merchandise is huge. I mean, it's a huge amount for Notre Dame.
Well, then we've got, but there's a kind of a big drop. This is kind of weird, in that they have Clemson, they got it worth $800 million with revenue at $196. The next is Oregon, which the revenue is $780, but they've got the valuation way down at $151. Now, four people down is Auburn, with a valuation left, but the revenue is back almost to $200. So it's a little bit of a, there's something going on here that I don't quite get. Iowa's like 21st, the Michigan State is 22nd, and the rest of the Big Ten school. Then you've got Stanford, Florida State. I'm kind of surprised Stanford's worth that much, but Illinois is like 25th. They got $148 million in revenue. Indiana's going to move up maybe a little bit. Then there's Mississippi, which I would not have guessed. South Carolina, Minnesota. Minnesota's kind of one of the lowest on the Big Ten. Then there's Louisville. There's Purdue's way down here at 567 on the valuation, 124. Then Kansas, Vanderbilt, Texas Christian. UNC Chapel Hill, Arizona, Pittsburgh, Mississippi, and late at the bottom one was Syracuse is down. Northwestern's, their revenue is only $118, so they mustn't be getting. They're still the live gate must still be a bigger percentage of their income than the pros, I would say by far, don't you think, than the TV rights still.
I would think Well, a bigger percentage, yeah. Then TV rights is huge, I think the ticket sales is probably a bigger percentage than, or maybe a little outsized, at least at some schools that fill up every week.
Well, the lowest Big Ten school is Northwestern. They got them at $118 million in revenue. So I'm going to guess that the TV part, I'm going to take a stab, is probably 55 to 60. And at the other 150 at Michigan is people pouring into the place, 100,000 people, and that kind of thing.
And then I would shift immediately into licensing. I don't know how much Michigan stuff you see in the Chicago area, but boy, where I live, I see people wearing Michigan stuff all the time.
Now, they don't share the licensing like the NFL, right?
I don't believe they do.
The NFL used to share. Remember, God, Kevin, we were young. Nobody could figure out why Miami's jerseys were so popular. They were gang colors or something.
Yeah,
they were like the number. They were like by far the number one selling jersey. Everybody's going, why the hell? Who cares about Miami? I guess they were gang. Whatever gang color is, I couldn't tell me what. Russ will be happy. University of Memphis, the revenue is $64 million. What? They're in the AAC, whatever that is.
American Athletic Conference.
So those guys, the AAC, the last three teams in here are those guys: East Carolina, University of South Florida, and University of Memphis. Boise State is in the Mountain West. Their revenue is $61 million, and I don't know what their TV contract is. Connecticut's down. Where's Connecticut? No, the Big East. Now, who the hell do they play? There's no. What football do they play? Everybody independently, or what?
They may be independent. Let me check that for you while you're talking.
Well, they got to be because there's no other football teams in the Big East, right?
Yeah, or they may have slid into another conference like the MAC or something. I know there's somebody that's in the MAC that surprised me.
I wanted to, all the stuff we did this week on the veteran stuff, and boy, was that lady yesterday about the most refreshing person you've talked to in ages?
Oh, yeah, yeah. The whole week has been fantastic, and I think what's interesting is I don't think we started out to say this should be a run-up to Veterans Day, but it sure did time out really well.
Yeah.
as a run-up to Veterans Day.
Well, the it just so happened because that was a day.
It's an independent. We're down to two independents in Division I football. It's Notre Dame and Connecticut. Okay, keep going.
The interesting part is how much everybody sort of matched up in the last 25 years. I mean, I'll bet she was part of the stuff that Mike's son was doing over in Afghanistan, where they were going from Taliban to this place and trying to get people to come over to our side and paying them off in $100 bills and all the weird stuff we did over there. I'm not going to say they knew each other, but I'll bet they were part of some of the same stuff.
Yeah, it could have been, certainly overlapped in terms of, their missions and responsibilities. Although, what was our guest's name yesterday? What was her first name?
Talia. So, I think
Talia.
Talia DeSantos.
Talia was. I mean, she was live with combat people. So
yeah.
So that was a little bit different than Mike's son, I think.
No, I'm saying, but I wonder if some of the places he went were part of the places their group sent him.
Oh, could have been.
Because she was in the logistics of all that stuff, and knew the language and everything, right?
Yeah.
So, man, I'm not saying they knew each other. I'm just saying you wonder how this stuff all kind of comes together, because it does, obviously, or else a lot of people do a lot of work before somebody lands someplace, right? You would hope.
Yeah. But anyway, yes, it was such, we've spent such an informative, little bit more than a week, and, I think really informative. And what's kind of cool about it, too, is I was listening yesterday, if you've had people in your life who suffer from anxiety or, other types of issues, to just hear it expressed another way, because, a lot of people don't want to talk about it. A lot of people will try to tell you, how you're feeling, and it's hard to relate if you have never, and I find this very difficult. It is hard for me to relate when I haven't had the experience. So I can listen, I can do my best to understand, but I don't really understand. And then I hear it worded a different way, and I say, oh, I see what I'm hearing now, what I'm hearing from people, someone in my life. who might do that. So it's informative in a lot of ways. I mean, certainly as it pertains to military service, it was, you know, it's been some really important topics. But I found that the ability to extrapolate, you know, what I heard between Mark and Talia, you know, I think that was extremely informative. It was extremely good for me anyway.
Well, I always get little things. Where's Dr. Mark? We need him. Things trip in your brain about stuff when you were young that you thought you forgot, but all you have to do is you can resurrect stuff out of your memory that you never thought you could. And what it did for me all week is it gave me like almost flashbacks to stuff like, well, my uncle got killed in Germany. My dad was in the South Pacific, and he had some kind of melanoma when he came back that they supposedly took off of it and didn't do a very good job. So he died of brain cancer sort of in the same spot. And my mother remarried, and he was not big on her hanging around with my real father's pals or anything. So I didn't know any of those people. And I just knew that my uncle was killed over there. I didn't really know anything about it. So one night, my aunt called up and said, you know, it's a command performance. You got to show up at this guy's wake. And it turns out he was the best man at my mom and dad's wedding. And I didn't know like, any of these guys. I'd never met him. And I show up, and all of a sudden, it's like, you know, a home week. And we end up, you know, closing some bar at 2 in the morning, as usual, Irish people. And they were all there was telling me about my uncle. I said, how do you not know about your uncle? I don't know about him, you know, other than the fact that I knew I had one and he was dead. Tell me all about him. He was a great ball player. He played in the Army. And he almost pro material, this kind of thing, second baseman. I don't know anything like that. And then as time went on the trading floor, you knew an awful lot of people, right? I mean, a lot of people know a lot of people, but unless you've worked in a room with, you know, 2,000 people, it's hard to know as many people as I got to know. I mean, I'm sure people do, but I'm saying it's a lot of people in one room. And I kind of shared a spot with a guy. So my mother dies, and his dad dies like the same time. So the day of my mother's funeral, after the funeral thing, I hot-footed off to his dad's wake up on the north side. I see all these medals there, and I go, Ronnie, you never told me your dad was a destroyer captain in the South Pacific. And Ronnie goes, how could I tell you? I didn't know. Like, you know, all of a sudden, as those guys were talking last week, I'm getting all these flashbacks about how people, I know my uncle was a fighter pilot. I think he had some kills. I don't know. He never talked about it other than the fact that he did it. And whenever anything happened, you know, a bee come in the car or something, my aunt would all fluster out. He'd say, just relax. We may all get stung. We're not going to die. It's not like somebody's shooting at you or something like that. I mean, that was about all we heard from him. And obviously, the guy had people on his behind shooting at him and stuff. They never, I don't know if that was, they just closed the, and the answer always was, I'm not a hero. The guys who didn't come back were heroes. I just did my job and got out of there as fast as I could. Audrey's dad, same way. You know, about being landing in Aleutians in the water, and oh, you guys can't start a fire. We think there might be a submarine out there, and half of them were either frostbite or damn near dying of being too cold. You know, all those guys, all week, I've kept getting all these flashbacks. Is that weird or what?
Yeah, it was. It was an interesting process. Yes, for sure. You know, the other thing that came up yesterday, and I'm glad because we really didn't get to explore it enough with Mike. You know, Mike talked a lot about the mechanics of getting out. And everything that you have to do, but there are also people who they may not have, you know, a battlefield related trauma, but if you do 20 years in the military and now you come out and you're trying to adapt to the real world, it's different, and that transition is difficult for some people. For some people, it's not. You know, you slide right in. There's certainly a lot of really, really well-known leaders who served in the military for a long time, so they're leading companies and so on. So it, you know, it works, and there's a lot about the model of accountability, of discipline, all of those things that translate. But you know, there's also an institution that you're leaving, and it's an institution with a lot more structure than you're going to see anyplace else. And I think it's really, it's got to be difficult, at least for some people, to make that transition away from the structure of the military and the routine, the regimen, and to try and succeed in a much, much looser world.
Okay, but I didn't want to...
I'm glad there was a little conversation about that yesterday.
Me too, but you know what? As usual, You and I think the same way. We come to the same conclusion. All it did was give me about 5,000 more questions.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I'd like to just... I'd like to follow, just like, you know, building a railroad car. Why I said that, I don't know. I want to know, Kevin O'Neill does his 6 years, he's someplace, and now he's out. Okay, where the hell are you out? Are you out in, what did Hal say, he was out in Washington State, that's where his base was. Well, what if Kevin's family is in Atlanta? Now, is our mom and dad still alive? Do they still have a house? Is there still a room for you for a while? You find something else? Is there any sense of a job? Is there any, where are your brothers and sisters? Well, he had two brothers, one's in New Hampshire, the other one's in God knows where. He's working in Europe or Mexico or some damn place. So there's no family. All your friends maybe are, the girls you might knew are all married to somebody else and have four kids. What is day one like? What is day two like? Do they get you home? Do they fly you home? Are you on the bus? I just like to have some kind of idea.
I agree with you, Tom. I suspect there's a lot of people, you know, they're anxious to get out, ready to move on all of a sudden, and now you land wherever you land, you know, and the first day you wake up, you go, okay, now what?
Yeah, what if, you know, we don't have, we used to be a lot bigger when we did all the future stuff and everything, but I'm not so sure if I got a resume, what would I do with this guy or girl? I mean, they're probably very bright, they probably are going to show up on time, are they going to have any chance of passing the Series 7? I mean, do they know anything about stocks and buy? I mean, what do you do with somebody? I mean, if you're in this, what's the Bureau of Ordnance or something, and you're ordering stuff every day, and you're putting all the stuff together to build a, you know, for a bomb or whatever it is, or to repair airplanes, I'm sure there's a place they could come by you and they'll blow through their first two things and supply management. And you got a star on your hands, okay? But they're not all like that. Like what did Mike say? If you're infantry, what do? You go find a mercenary army? I mean, what does that guy do?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of skills that translate to industry, but it's not necessarily the direct skills. So just to give you an example, we get a lot of people at Ivy Tech who come out of the military, and we actually have some very specific training programs that we will use to give them credit, academic credit for logistics courses. So I can only speak to that program. We have others I know, but you know, this is, you know, because we have, you can do it nursing, you know, some of those, but I don't know those programs like I know the supply chain and logistics stuff. So you know, we're really big on the military crosswalk, which is what we call it, and how you give them, you know, how they earn credits and then how they finish off their degrees, maybe an associate's degree or whatever, and it's GI Bill supported, and so on. I think that's fantastic. But after the last week, I'm going to get with my chancellor in South Bend and say, you know, let's look at some of these, because we do a good job of accommodating military in terms of academics, but how do we support the other transition issues that come up? And so I'm going to see if I can get them to listen to some of our shows from the archive and see where we go from there. Because I do think that's, you know, that might be something that we, well, I know it's something that we can do better, because I don't think we're addressing it at all right now.
Well, she mentioned Columbia, and a lot of people, she said, were, not a lot, she said she was a 25-year-old in the class, would be looking at her, but I never saw, and my stepfather went to DePaul on the GI Bill. Are there some places that, but first of all, where do you even apply? I mean, you have this grant. So let's say you get mustered out in April. Can you make the fall quarter? I didn't see any.
Yeah, you can. I mean, there's stuff you have to file, and every school has financial aid people. You know, so we have financial aid people. I just sit somebody down with financial aid people, and they'll work it out. There are some restrictions on what you can do. You know, how many online courses you can take, for example, as far as the VA goes. There, you know, you're only allowed to take, you know, one per term or two per term, something like that. So you have to be careful about, you know, where you sign people up, because they won't be covered if you give them.
Well,
too
are
much
there
on.
Certain schools that? I mean, I never saw anybody at Notre Dame who was sitting in a class of 25. Did you?
Hi, this is Larissa Dominguez. Hey. I'd like to jump in. Hi.
Please jump in.
How you doing?
Yeah, we had students at Kelly.
Okay.
At the IU that were military students who were a little bit older sitting in our class.
Okay.
Getting their degree. So I do know that some students do make that transition. I think a bigger challenge is how do you really make sure that the students know about the program and how to implement the program? I think there is a knowledge gap there as well. Even if you give somebody information on it, I think there's a lot of people that struggle with really taking that next step, even if they want it, because they just don't understand how academia works.
Well, that's what we're trying to. By the way, Dr. Larissa Dyniak, we're trying to fill in the blanks of somebody gets mustered out in Washington, and how do they make it into your class 4 months later? What's the procedure? She did say you could file for unemployment. Okay, but I don't think there's any severance from the military, is there? I don't think so, but maybe there is. So how does somebody get from there to applying to Kelly or Purdue or Notre Dame and getting the application, getting a place to live? It seems to be one hell of a 4 months.
It really does. And again, academia is a tricky thing. If you're unfamiliar with how tuition works, discounts work, how scholarships work, it almost seems too daunting to go forward. And I think that this is true not only for people in the military, but for people who are maybe first-generation students, and they simply don't understand how the system works. And then what's great about Ivy Tech is being able to take classes at Ivy Tech and transfer them. But if they don't understand what classes that they need to take or develop that plan, it can become very difficult. Even with the assistance of an academic advisor, it's sometimes, I think, a very daunting task for these individuals.
Well, Kevin,
I'll second that, too, because half of it is just the language of it, as it is in any industry, is understanding the lingo. But, you know, when someone says, okay, now take that to the bursar's office, what's a bursar? you start getting those kinds of issues, and there's a whole structure to it and a whole drill to it that even when I first came on as a full-time professor, I was sitting there saying, you know, what's that? How do you do that? And you're right, it would be people coming out of the military, but it's also a big deal for those first-gen students because they can't go back to mom and dad and say, what did they just tell me?
Right.
Do people get their high school equivalency if they don't have it in the military? Can you get it in there, or is that something that's a problem too?
I have no idea.
Yeah, I can't speak to that specifically if it's a military issue. I don't doubt for a minute that there is support for getting a GED. And I know we have some corporations locally where they use our campus, but we don't specifically do GED courses, but they use our campuses. So there are places like that that support their students getting, or their employees getting GED. So, you know, why wouldn't the military do the same?
Well, I mean, if somebody ditched...
But I don't know that for a fact.
Say, if somebody ditched halfway through their senior year in high school and doesn't have a degree, will you still let them in?
At Ivy Tech, I don't believe that they will let somebody in.
Yeah, got a high school degree.
I think the departed, since we can't ask him, so he's no longer around, Mike Tooman, Judge Tooman. I think, get a load of this, Larissa. The dude was going into New Trier, and he got booted out because he stole the security guy's car for a joyride or something.
Okay.
So he said, I'm not going back there.
Hey, Judge Material, you knew it back then.
So, so he kind of blew that off, and then he went to the Marines. And I think he got his high school equivalency in the Marines somehow. So when he came out, he went to, I don't know where he went, and then he went to law school at DePaul, and he ended up being this pretty famous judge. But yeah, what a way to get there. But I think he somehow got his high school equivalency in the Marines. Now, I don't know what the process is there, but he didn't have to go back to high school when he came out. That I know, somehow. He went into college. Now, when the government writes a check for GI Bill, do they write the check to the school or the person? Do we know?
Goes to school.
So does that cover? Does the person getting that, Larissa, still need a loan at Kelly? Or does it cover the whole thing?
Well, I can't speak to the specifics, but if the tuition is more than the bill gives you, you will need a loan.
Okay.
Then on the reverse, is it if there is more money from the bill than what's given, you'll get what's called a reimbursement. So you'll get that distribution check afterwards.
So we think it's a flat fee. We think it's, you know, 30 grand a year. It's not 70 if you go to this school or 20 if you go to this school.
Right. It will not be school dependent.
Okay.
This is how even loans work. So if you take out a loan to go to school, the loan pays the school directly. And if there's leftover money, you will get that as a disbursement.
Okay. Wow.
Now, you know, that comes with strings attached about,
yes,
you know, attendance, performance. We mm-hmm. we have a lot of built-in reporting dates where we have, you know, we're required to report. Has this student been coming to class? And this is, it's 100%. I report the whole class, not just one. But it only translates in terms of financial aid. At least that's the big impact. When, you know, when people, you say, you know, there's the 60% part of the year. In fact, I'm about to hit that for the second 8 weeks. It, you know, has this student been participating? And you just go through and it's a yes or no. But it's a whole data gathering thing because there are, you know, there are requirements other than you enrolled and you got paid.
Well, and it's to help, particularly with the institutions that are for-profit. So the for-profit institutions would send out these checks to these schools, and the students would get their refund check, their disbursement, and then they would not go to any classes. So now the for-profit university has generated the revenue. The student is now on the hook for this tremendous amount of debt, and it became a weird scam. And one of the reasons why we now report the attendance is to hopefully circumvent some of that. But getting back to the military, that's also really good for people in the military if they really do understand those strings attached to it, the importance of attending class and the importance of what you're doing and why you're doing it, that class really isn't optional.
Yeah, which as instructors we love because we like it when our people show up.
Yeah, it makes the class a lot easier.
Well, also, you know,
I can see why my undergraduate professors hated me.
Yeah,
we had a guy, Professor Croteau. You ever heard of him?
I had JT.
He was actually at one point he was the only full economics professor at Notre Dame, I think. And he'd come in and he'd grumble about the administration all the time and stuff. He was a character. He was an expert on the credit unions and nonprofit organizations, Larissa. He actually wrote a book, The Economics of the Credit Union, which I still have. Pretty interesting. And we had a Friday class, right? It was my senior year. And, of course, it was a gorgeous day, which you never get in South Bend. And like, nobody showed up. And he goes, I know. He goes, I would have liked to have been out there playing golf, too. He said, but get together, a few people got to show up just for a little respect.
Right.
He goes, I don't care if you draw straws and the losers have to show up. You got to have a few people. He was a character.
You're right.
Yeah, my favorite Chrono story was in probably money and banking class or something like that, where, you know, he walked in a couple minutes late. He immediately, he's got a couple of books. He just slammed them down on the desk, and he's fuming. And about three times he started to say something and stopped himself. And then finally he says, you know, every institution has its fair share of idiots. Around here, they all seem to have gravitated to administration.
That's funny.
What did Dr. McCoy say on Star Trek? The bureaucratic mind has been a constant through the ages. Listen, did you have a chance to listen to any of the veteran stuff this week? I know you probably didn't, but we've had kind of a veterans week. That's why we're kind of on this subject.
No, I unfortunately was not because I had to teach class.
Oh, right, I get it.
Yeah.
We ended up, I don't know who's, Diane Kelly started it. We're talking about Fisher House, and then Kenny said that he was a money raising thing for an outfit called Headstrong, and they raised $4 million, and they do psychology stuff, and it so happens that one of my roommates in school and a good friend of Kevin's as well, Dr. Johnson, did a lot of work. He was in the Army, and he became a psychologist with the Army essentially putting him through school, and he worked with a lot of those people, know all the history, all the different types of PTSD, different wars, different family issues, you know, support issues, those a whole bit he went through. Then a lady who, Talia, came on yesterday, and she had been helped by this Headstrong group. She's kind of a, what'd she say, Kevin? She's a perfectionist to the extreme, and whenever something didn't go right, you know, she took it personally, and which a lot of people do. Anyway, she tried to get help this place, that place, and then all of a sudden these Headstrong people really helped her out. So now she's helping them out, she's working for them, and anyway, just an amazingly refreshing person.
Let's fill in the blanks a little more. She learned Pashto, I forget what the language was, when she was in the Army, and so her job was translating in real time what the enemy were saying in mid-battle,
right,
for U.S. troops. So as you can imagine, that being an incredibly stressful job, and so now, you know, when you start dealing with some of the PTSD that people have in the battlefield, you know, you're losing people too. So she had that issue, and then this idea of perfectionism that, you know, if I make the slightest mistake, people die. If I make it in transition, it was a pressure cooker for her, and it took its toll. And she really told a compelling story. If you have time to listen to the archive over the weekend or something, about 30 minutes into yesterday's show is when they got started.
Well, and you just tell by listening to her that she was going to take this to heart. Is that just the way she is? You can just tell by, before she said 10 words, Kevin, both of us knew that, right? She actually cared about what she was doing.
That's great.
And it was another theme, Kevin, kind of, I don't know why it's my business side, picked it up. Mike Murphy was on, and Mike's a vet, and he comes on the show every once in a while. Good guy, another one of our college buddies. He talked about how he enlisted after his Notre Dame degree, and how there was kind of a contract of what he was going to do for them and what they were going to do for him. And he said, virtually every stage, he had a fight for them to do. It was like they never read his contract. You know, they didn't want to send him to language school. They didn't want to send him to officer school, but it was right there. So he ended up having to fight all the way through. And then I was at a birthday party / cookout where a guy was telling me, I went in and I was supposed to be a language guy, and they told me I was going to learn, you know, French. I was going to do stuff in Africa. And all of a sudden they got me in, was it Pashto? That's what he was taking too. I mean, they just switched on him. And they didn't send him to the right language school and blah, blah, blah. And then Lou and I were talking about, Lou, if people get in there with the idea that they're going to become a citizen, and that's the promise, how do people leave when they aren't citizens? And Lou said, well, you got to push the process. It doesn't just happen automatically. And what was Hal saying about how they were supposed to make him a nuclear engineer, and he ended up in the bowels of some ship for 5 years or 4 years, and he never got what they promised him either. So, I mean, I don't think that's so cool, do you? I mean, Mike was smart enough to fight for it.
You've got to honor any of these commitments have to be honored. And so that's, you know, that to me is a huge policy issue that needs to be addressed, because we kept hearing it enough for me to believe it is a big deal that we have right now.
Yeah, we're like 4 for 4. they don't do what they say they're going to do. But Mike at least is smart enough to push it. But I think he had his on paper. Maybe those other guys didn't.
Hey, I gotta get going. So I am going to leave you with Dr. Larissa, and you guys can finish up the hour, and then I will talk to you on Friday.
All right, Kevin, take care of yourself.
Kevin, it was nice speaking to you again.
Yeah, we'll be in touch. Bye.
Don't tell him that. He gets a big head real easy.
Well, I like Kevin.
You know, so do I. But there's all kinds of valuations of teams here. There's stuff going on in the economy. The shutdown, I was on a national show yesterday, Larissa, and the guy was saying something about the CPI numbers. The CPI numbers came out, didn't they? Or were they an estimate, or Why am I reading it? The numbers are that didn't come out. I swore those things came out because we had a show about it.
They are estimates at this point. Because, okay. Yeah.
All right. So there was no labor estimate, but there was a CPI estimate. Is that what happened?
I think so.
Okay. Well, that would make sense then. What do you make of all this? With this, the shutdown happening, and then all of a sudden we're kind of back together, and it seems like I've mentioned it before, and I'm gonna go through the whole thing again. It seems like you shouldn't have these shutdowns because people voted for all this stuff somewhere along the line, and yet it seems like we're the deficit's growing faster than all the estimates of the Bureau of Accounting and those people, which means that people are lying evidently in the estimates, and somewhere along the line, you can see why one side objects. And it's always the other side and so forth. But now that we're back together, we're back to what? We're back to business as usual? What's so good about business as usual?
Well, it's funny. I recently wrote a paper just on the question, do the financial markets care about the government shutdown? Because we've had quite a few shutdowns since 1995. So it's happened amongst lots of different presidents. Mr. Trump just has more under his belt than other people do, but there have been several shutdowns. So we've had one in November of 95, December of 95 that lasted through 96, 2013, January of 2018, February of 2018, those were both for President Trump, December 2018, and now this one. It's just interesting, and what I did was I compared what was going on in the VIX with the shutdowns, and the government or the VIX really didn't have much of a reaction to these shutdowns. It was like they were happening and the market didn't have this crisis mode, and it was neutral. At the beginning, I want to say there was one back in the one in 2013 that lasted for 16 days. There was a little bit more of fear and concern, and you saw a little bit of a spike. But the rest of them, the markets just really had almost a null reaction to what was happening with the government shutdown, which I think was, at least to me, I thought was very interesting.
From the other side of it, if you instead of having a real job and teaching people all day, if you listen to the financial news, which I do, which I can't stand, but I do it's my job to watch for other people, right? The attitude is so totally different from yours, it's scary. 2 weeks, what's the point? If the market goes down, it's an opportunity to buy. 2 weeks, we're back, everybody gets paid. And a deal. It's like the dismissiveness part of it doesn't affect us. Who cares? Some people don't get paid for a while. They have a little bit of stuff. Doesn't affect us at this level at all. Don't even think about it in terms of whether the market's going to react to it. I mean, that's the attitude.
It is. It's the attitude. And it to me, that was really surprising. You would think that there'd be some care about it. But to your point, it's... You know, if the market goes down, it's an opportunity, and the market will correct itself, and this will be short-lived. And the number, I think part of it is, it almost feels like the number of people who are directly impacted isn't high enough for the entire population to care about.
Well, the wealthy population could care less.
Sure.
But I don't say they won't care. They don't even know. They don't care to know, so they don't care. How's that for a dumb statement?
Mm-hmm.
If you don't know about it, you don't care. And you make sure you don't know about it.
Right. You just pretend it didn't happen. And the shutdowns happen for a variety of different reasons. So, for example, when Obama was as president, the big fight was about Obamacare, and we had a shutdown for that. There was issues around immigration policies. So it's more than just simply what budgetary concerns, but it's a lot of other political things that go into it. And maybe as a nation, we're tired of some of that.
Well, I think if I were to put, and I'd love to run this by you because I haven't run it by you yet, if there is, I'll say, a legitimate reason. I mean, these things happen at a time when, even though we have bills that people pass and they sign and there's a spending plan and a budget and all this, well, there isn't really a budget, is there? But we have the spending plan and we have, you know, two guys that my neither one of them should be president. You know, Biden comes up with some massive plan about infrastructure, and oh, by the way, it's going to be accretive because, you know, in a bad neighborhood, they're going to have Wi-Fi and all of a sudden everybody's going to be at work and they're going to pay taxes and whatever, God name it, we talk about that. Then Trump comes up with some stupid tax cut bill and says at the end of the day we're going to end up with more money than we did before. Reagan tried that and it didn't work, so I'm not going to believe it a second time. So when you get to the... So all this should add up to some place where we're borrowing X number. Well, the number is always much greater than X. So,
yes, it is.
So whoever's the other side or whatever side it is says, hey, wait a minute, whatever's going on here, I'm not saying there isn't all the other stuff you talked about, there aren't these, quote, other issues, but by and large, is the debt is going up faster, we're spending more than people told us we were going to, and now we don't want to, we need to relook at this. And people say, well, why do you relook at it? You idiot, you voted for it. Yeah, I voted for it, but it was supposed to do this, and it didn't, and now look where we are. So I think there is some, behind the scenes, at least because that's the day they decide to start the shutdown, there is some number behind it. There is some idea that we're spending money faster than we told people we were going to, I think. Now, that's just, and please tell me I'm nuts, but whatever. There is, because it happens on that day, I think there is something to that.
Just well, saying. And I also think I like how you described that we've got these spending ideas, and what we're ending up with is not the end result that we were hoping for.
Right.
For example, if everybody in a poor neighborhood had Wi-Fi, the expectation that everybody will be working, it's not realistic. I was speaking to somebody maybe about a year ago who was talking about building better banking infrastructure so that when you deposit a check, you would have the money more quickly. And their argument was that this would help the economics of the people on the south side of Chicago.
Oh, bull.
And I said to this gentleman, I said, well, I don't think that, because his argument was this was a financial technology problem and that we need to build out the infrastructure technologically better. And I said, well, even if we were able to make all of these transactions more quick and this to happen in maybe a real-time position, we've got a couple of issues. One, banking regulation and implementing things like this takes years to implement. This isn't something that a bank could say, okay, I'm going to change my deposit system, the entire infrastructure, and we're just going to roll it out. It takes years of testing. It needs regulation. It needs oversight. It's a long, long process.
Did this gentleman...
And then, what difference does it make how quick the money can get transferred if you don't have any money?
Does this gentleman I'm assuming it's a gentleman, have any clue what percentage of people on the South Side still cash their check at a currency exchange and don't even have a bank?
Well, I don't think so.
Well, I mean, you would think before you would opine on something like that, you would have some knowledge that we're talking about people who go to the currency exchange and cash your check, for God's sake.
Well, and so he comes from a computer science background.
Oh, God. Oh,
and
God.
I was saying, he was making the argument that this is a financial technology issue. And I said, this is a socioeconomic issue. It's not financial technology. It's really about how do you better assist those people in this community. And again, giving everybody Wi-Fi isn't necessarily going to change what they're doing if they don't have jobs, if they don't, you know what I mean? Like,
oh,
it's
yeah.
just...
It's nuts. I mean, why would you even think that there was my significant other, who's on the show every other week, Audrey, is in real estate, and not recently, but through the years, she has had some people from, you know, whatever neighborhood you want to call it, and looking for their first house. And we're talking about, they were like two or three ladies, all in their early 30s, had a job, saving up some dough. Where they're putting it, I have no idea, but they were looking for a house, still were cashing their check at the currency exchange. And Audrey says, "You don't have a bank? What are you doing there? what do you mean?" Well, I've always cashed at the currency exchange. I said, "You need a banking relationship. You need, this is a deposit. You don't want to be carrying around all that cash. I mean, well, for God's sake." I mean, it's you know, and we're talking about well-dressed people with a real job, you know. I mean, this hasn't been for a while, but it's, I think somebody needs to do research what they're talking about, for God's sake. Just a little bit.
Well, again, it was, for me, it was kind of a fun conversation. Yeah. Because at the end, this gentleman finally, and he, you're right, it was a gentleman, finally conceded and said, "Oh, this isn't a technology problem."
No.
It's not.
What in class do you, I assume you're going to get some questions about current events and what's going on in the world. What are you hearing from pretty younger people?
I don't get questions about current events in my classes.
Really?
Nope.
How do you dodge it?
Well, they don't, for a couple of reasons. For right now, I'm teaching, for example, right now, one of my classes that I'm teaching is called Investments.
Okay.
And those students are working their tushies off, so to speak, just trying to keep up with the material.
But then doesn't somebody say, "God, why does the market go up every day?"
No, I'd be thrilled if they asked that question.
When I kind of scoffed at, now we're back to business as usual, and the president's having all these guys from Wall Street for dinner tonight, evidently. I don't know if he's going to pass the hat or what, which seems to be his his style. But this back to business as usual now with the Fed, I can't believe we've been doing this for pushing 20 years now, that we're pumping money into the system more than we should, and just inflating property values, and we're inflating stock values in this K-shaped recovery. I've never seen anything like this, or anywhere in my lifetime, where so many people seem like it's money for nothing and your chicks for free, like they used to say in MTV. There's no concept of money. Money's worth nothing. Just whatever the tab is, I'll take it. Whatever the car is, I'll take it. Meanwhile, you see the bottom 80% cutting coupons, for God's sake. I mean, the last time we were at this disparate of an economy was 1929, and I sure as hell don't want to see that happen again. What is the end game here? I mean, now it looks like instead of the Fed cutting back a little bit on this inflation stuff, this guy wants the poor people in the Fed to open the floodgates even more. He wants Mar-a-Lago or the Doral worth $90 bazillion, and everybody else doesn't have a dime. I mean, what is the end game here? Is there a way we can get out of this without a mess? I mean, some of the guys on the show say no. I'm hoping the answer somehow is yes, but how does the economy ever catch up to some of these stocks when you know, I see revenue per share so damn high I can't even count it. Not even earnings per share, that I can understand. I mean, I see IBM here up again today. It's up another $5. And last week, Kevin sent around a thing about how much money they've made putting in these systems in China to surveil their people for the government. And we think that's all. What are we doing here exactly? I don't know. I know it's a big question, but is anybody around that can tie any of this stuff together? I don't think we have one in the White House. I'm not so sure anybody could, but I know he can't. Or doesn't want to. I mean, what do you see this all going?
Well, and I'm going to quote Russell here.
Uh-oh.
So last week, when I was listening to Russell speak, he made a comment that the derivatives market has it priced in that there are going to be rate hikes next year to try to slow down the economy. So if that's true, and again, slowing down the economy, which would then reverse some of the things that you're talking about with pumping in money into the economy, the problem or the issue with slowing down the economy is that it will stop, or theoretically it should slow down investment into business. So the businesses are going to be looking less to create new projects, look for new markets, or invest more in technological growth for better infrastructure. And if that starts to slow down, theoretically, we could have lower jobs, new job creations. There could be a situation of layoffs to get rid of excess force because money is more expensive. To your point, it's no longer money for nothing and your chicks for free. You're really starting to pull back. To me, the issue with that is the people that are going to be most affected are those people in the bottom half, right? We keep talking about our society being into two. And if we're have our society into two, it's not the people who are doing very well right now who are really enjoying the money for free. It's those coupon clippers that you're talking about. So those coupon clippers are going to be impacted even harder.
Do you mind if we go to break and then we'll talk about this? But hold that thought. Well, let's kind of go through, maybe we come back to kind of the history of this. And I was once, you know, somebody sitting in a class like yours, learning what you're teaching, and it was a long time ago, and it made so much sense. I think we've managed to screw up the economy so bad that a lot of the stuff you're teaching doesn't even really, I mean, I'm not saying you shouldn't learn it, they should, because theory is always good, but I don't think the theory matches what's going on at all, do you?
I think to some extent it does, and I think we're pretending it doesn't.
Well, let's debate that afterward, because I'm gonna try and get some knowledge out of you, because I agree with you, but I want to dig further. How's that sound? SP Futures up 22, NASDAQ Futures up 152. Be right back.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients, and you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are or what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here.
Loan Repack Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howie, Andrew on the board. SP Futures up 22, NASDAQ Futures up 150. As we still thinking we're coming closer and closer to this the ending of this government shutdown. The question I want to ask Larissa when I'm done with this is, do we think that the fact that they wouldn't let corporate jets, private jets, land at 12 airports is the reason why the shutdown is ending? Well, that's awful cynical, but I'll roll with that for a second anyway. All right, over in Europe, real quick, we got the DAX up 306, 1.3%. FTSE's actually down a point, so let's call that flat. CAC, however, they're drinking the Kool-Aid, up 104, 1.3%. In Asia, Nikkei up 220.4%, Hang Seng up 222.85%, Shanghai down 2, call that flat. Again, they're not playing ball here either. Oil, down 81 cents, right about 60 bucks, 60.23. This thing is stuck on 60. I don't know when's it going to come off there, one way or the other. Gold up another 19 bucks, 41.35. Still not 4,300, but way above the 3,900 it got down to. Silver's been the horse here, up 83 cents, 51.58. Thankfully, we had a lot of people long silver. They have a nice week. It's always good when your people make some dough. Foreign exchange, Euro 115.7, so the dollar is still pretty strong. The yen is at a nine-month low, okay, and the British pound is 131. It was 135, and again, we're going to dig some knowledge out of Larissa's. What does a 2% move in a currency mean? Nobody really pays attention to it, but maybe it's something you ought to. Bitcoin up 2,000 points, 104.884. What do you got for us? Traffic, weather, and sports? Not much sports last night. Tuesday's a dead night.
Yeah, it was, that's exactly what I was going to bring up. It is 7:35 here in Chicago on Wednesday the 12th. And yeah, I was literally going to check and I was going to be like, I'm not really seeing anything. So is there something I missed? So yeah, skipping the sports, going on straight to weather. It's currently 40 degrees today, right now. It's going to be sunny and breezy throughout the day. We're going to have a high of 53. The wind chills are bringing it down. It feels more like, I think, about 35 or so. Over in Phoenix, they're currently at 62 degrees. They have partly sunny skies, and they're going to have a high of 85 degrees. And finally, for Chicago traffic, also not as bad as the usual. Of course, not great either. No major accidents to report. Inbound traffic is building a little bit, but it's going to take you about 50 minutes if you're coming in all the way from the end of the Kennedy, as opposed to the whole hour. Only thing to take note of is that the outbound Eisenhower is running a little slower than usual. It's going to take about 50 minutes to get out to Wolf Road. So that's all I got. Back to you, Chief.
Larissa, we'll talk to you a little bit about the currency stuff, but just on where we were going. Now, you're going to say in class, and Russell, who obviously is a brilliant man, is he out buying new cardigans today, or where is he?
Oh, well, he's doing another presentation for FutureCast.
Oh, okay. Well, good for him. And he's going to talk about interest rates, and if the market overheats, the Fed is going to have to go the other way and raise some rates. Can you imagine... I'm not asking you a political question. Maybe I am. You imagine how bad the numbers are going to have to be here, seeing as we'll fire the guy if they're bad numbers, for them to actually do that. What do you think our inflation is going to be? 10% before they do that? Before they recognize the problem?
Oh, no, I don't. I don't think our inflation will get that high. I don't think that our inflation will get nearly that high.
But I'm saying, what has to happen for this Fed, with the pressure being put on them, to actually raise rates?
Oh, I think, again, I'm now going back to Russell. The market already thinks that the rates will be raised in the upcoming year. But as to your point, the economy, the stock market is doing really well. And when you start to have the economy really start to take off and you've got these overinflated prices, you need to slow things down. And the fastest way to slow things down is to simply raise rates, make it more expensive for continual growth. And what that does is it allows for companies to really take a deeper thought about their projects that they're going to be investing in and make smarter decisions, as opposed to we've got free money, so to speak, and we are just going to invest in anything because essentially anything is going to generate excess returns. So if you're thinking about it from a capital budgeting standpoint, a new project's going to generate, let's say, a rate of return of 5%, but funding, and remember, we had funding, cheap funding for a long time. Let's say funding was around 0 or 1%, you're making a 4% return. Now, if funding is closer to 4 or 5%, and you're looking at a project that's going to be 5%, that's going to generate a rate of return of 5%, that project no longer looks attractive. And as a result, you're going to be much more selective about the types of projects you're going to invest. The counter, and what often happens, is not only do companies make more strategic decisions on their direct investments within their company, they start to hoard cash. And so we've had problems with that a couple of times in the market, where once rates start to hike up, as opposed to making smarter decisions about investments, what companies really end up doing is starting to hoard cash. And that slows down the economy even further.
I'm gonna guess that your classes are pretty darn good, because I used to sit in a lot of them, and you're spot on. here's the wrinkle I'm gonna throw at you. Is it in theory? By the way, you've worked in private industry, right? I mean, I used to actually do this stuff for Pullman, where you had, or actually Allied Van Lines as well, where you had your rate of return you wanted to get was 10%, and you're borrowing at 6%, and you'd find the rate of profit on something. And exactly what you're saying is perfectly true, except somehow in the last 15 years, we have managed to totally screw this up in such a way where if the Fed were to lower rates down to 1.5%, now why would they be so stupid ever to do that? But they did. Okay, mm-hmm. But now you got a guy like me who digs through the stuff, and I did this maybe 3-4 years ago, Marissa, and I found out that the rate of credit card, the rates actually during the 10-year period where the published interest rates were going down actually were going up. So the bifurcation of which people were able to borrow, like in other words, if you and I had Chief and Larissa Plumbing, and all of a sudden we had four vans, which probably outfit a whole van is probably $100,000, and then hire a couple of people. If we were going to go from four vans to five, which is really what every politician dribbles off their mouth like diarrhea, for God's sake, is they're going to help the lower and middle class. I'm going to say our rate never got below 7.5, if we could find some place, and I'll bet we had a sign over our house to guarantee the loan because of Dodd-Frank. Meanwhile, the other people are doing what Carl was saying, are able to borrow money below actually what the inflation rate was, despite what they're telling us. And that's what causes this a massive blow up in value for some people and not others. Where somebody can actually, why do you think that people are able to borrow to buy a football team for $9 billion when they're making $200 million? And you and I are going to sit right there and go, who the hell would do that? Well, if your inflation rate over the next 5 years that nobody admits to is really 6%, guess what? In 5 years, you sell a thing for even more. It has nothing to do with what you make. So how do you, what you're teaching, I don't think that you can go into all this stuff because you're like telling people what you just told them is no good. But it is good. I'm with you. But how have we managed to get around the theory to the extent we have?
Because the practical application of the theory isn't in line with how people truly behave. This is one of the reasons why behavioral finance has become such an important topic in the last 30 years. We had this idea of how people are supposed to behave, but that doesn't necessarily line up with how they truly behave, right? So we have this idea that you're going to be a rational investor, which means you're going to maximize your returns while minimizing your risk. And people don't behave that way. We've got people who are addicted or adrenaline to maximizing, they will maximize risk. I like to, when I talk about behavioral finance, I like to pick on Michael Jordan.
Yeah.
Because I really like Michael Jordan. And I made a comment that Michael probably isn't a rational investor. And I don't know him, so I cannot make this. This is not a, I'm not saying one way or the other because I don't know him. But in a rational investor, again, maximizing returns and minimizing risk, Mr. Jordan does not need to maximize returns anymore. He's most likely looking at wealth preservation. And if you're looking at wealth preservation and he's got over, I think the last I heard, he had over $2 billion, well, he's not looking to put that money to work, so to speak. And getting back to your point, if you're looking at these very wealthy individuals who would be willing to buy a sports team, they're not looking at generating substantial amounts of excess returns. They're looking at doing things that will generate returns, but they're not as worried about what a hedge fund might be doing to exploit market anomalies.
Well, we have people with so much cash. How do you even see when I was the age of the people that you're doing, the interest rates were 10 or 12%. So the idea of implied interest was on the tip of everybody's tongue. Does anybody even know what you meant when you say that now?
I don't think so. It depends on the generation of people I'm talking to. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it literally got to the point where if somebody, when the rates got to like 14%, if somebody would have said, Dr. Demiak, you just won $1 million lotto, but you're not going to get paid for 10 years. You almost would have said, keep it.
Yeah.
not exactly, but because the money you would have got today would have been, what, 200? 250 right. or something. I mean, that was your mindset, and now nobody thinks that way, because what the good doctor is talking about is that if you are sitting there and the firm can borrow money at 7%, and you find a project that is going to return 10%, you might say it's too close. I'm not going to do it. But then, if Dr. Demiak walks in and says, "Guess what? The rates are now down to 6%." You might say, "Okay, I'll do it." That's the whole theory that you and Russell are talking about, and it's perfectly correct. Except the system doesn't seem to work that way anymore. Some people are, I mean, if you look at the Bears' valuation, I know I'm skipping around, but it's all the same subject. I hope you're picking that up. The Bear valuation is $8 billion. All right. So the last year, let's say the team made $200 million, and I'm going to say that. Right away, going through your mind, Russell's mind, and my mind, wait a minute. If I borrowed $8 billion, and even if I could get a 6% rate, where the hell am I going to get that? I have no idea. That's $480 million a year, and I'm only making $200.
Right.
Who's going to write the $280 million check year one? What man or moron would do that? But because of the way we've skewed this down, we're going to let the state, back the money part. Maybe they can borrow from the state at 3% and do it tax-free. Or maybe they're going to get their property taxes stuck for 10 years or something. We're going to give all these advantages to where in 5 years from now, even though the team's still not making $480 million, it's going to be worth $12 billion. And that's dangerous, I think. I mean, even though in the last 15, 20 years, if you thought that way, you got a lot of money, way more than you and I do. But how long can that go on, I guess is my question.
And more importantly, why do the Bears keep losing? We're investing this much money. Why are they losing?
Well, they get a load of this. The coach and the other team, I don't know if you saw this, they're basically kicking the Bears' ass, right? So they get this quarterback. The quarterback goes down. He gets whacked. He gets a concussion. He has to come out, and he fumbles. They would have been up like 3 touchdowns at that point, or maybe not that much. So all of a sudden, the Bears get the ball back, and they start playing better, and the Bear quarterback is becoming really pretty good. So the Bears are cheering the victory. Meanwhile, the other team's so pissed off they fire the coach. So how's that for respect for the Bears? You lost to these mopes. We're firing you. We're firing your ass. If you wrote a book like this, would anybody read it? They would think it was crazy. That you'd be nuts.
That's funny.
what do you think of Purdue, Indiana, Notre Dame? All those valuations we talked about earlier. What's going to happen there?
You know, I don't know. I'll be curious because you're looking at what in the Chicagoland area, both Chicago and Northwestern, pardon me, have had financial troubles. And who would have ever thought either of those institutions would have issues?
Do they really have issues?
Pardon me?
Do they really have issues?
Well, Northwestern had made some mistakes with their endowment, and then right now, Chicago has issues because they have borrowed too much. They can utilize their endowment to help pay that down. It's just not a choice that most want because the endowment usually represents the overall economic health of the institution. Endowment size is what really predicts whether or not the institution is going to be able to keep going. So institutions with smaller endowments have a higher likelihood of closing.
Oh, yeah.
And there's particularly if you're a smaller institution, if you can't raise the funds and have your endowment be sustainable, the chance of you closing jumps up dramatically. Now, Notre Dame and Purdue and Indiana have very large endowments. So from that perspective, their valuation should be fine without, problems. There are really great ways to raise capital for those institutions. So they have lots of, not only do they get tuition, but really the money comes down from the donations from from other outside institutions and alumni. So there's lots of opportunities for them to continue to raise money.
Larissa, the model, and I think it's still there. I mean, I went to the University of Chicago Business School. Is the model at Purdue in Indiana, and I know there's a couple at Notre Dame. I met. Do you guys? They're real big on the endowed professorships. So when you say the endowment, there might be, I'm going to say 150 or maybe more pots of money that is just for that professor's spot. Now, that's not the Purdue or Indiana or Notre Dame model, is it? In Chicago, that's pretty much what people did. I mean, I think they still do.
Purdue, Notre Dame, and Indiana all have endowed professors.
But, I mean, to the same extent?
I mean,
everybody in the economics school, there had to be eight guys when I was there.
I don't know the percentage of endowed chairs, but it's a pretty popular way to fund.
Now, that's all separate from the regular endowment. In other words, they can't, that's for that, that's isolated or segregated. They can't borrow against that, can they? Because it's for that purpose, correct?
Correct.
As a matter of fact, well, you probably know this. I had two classes from George Stigler. I'm sure you've heard the name. And it was the Charles R. Walgreen. And I don't think, Larissa, it was the Walgreen family. There's another guy with a name, I think. It was a Charles R. Walgreen endowed chair. That chair, Stigler died, some other guy, three Nobel Prize winners in the last 45 years out of his endowment. That's scary or what? All in the same chair.
Well, it's good. So as a faculty member, securing one of those endowed chairs is very good for you professionally. It is a milestone achievement for an academic.
But some schools push that more than others. I mean, Notre Dame, I think the only full professor that was endowed was Professor Croteau that Kevin and I were talking about. Of course, that was a long time ago, but Chicago, that's, I can't imagine how many they have in like the other schools. I bet they have 500 across all, but I don't think anybody else has that, do they?
Actually, looking up.
Yeah, chairs. I mean, I'm talking about this like I know what I'm talking about. I just know from the economic school, virtually all those guys had a spot, they had an endowed spot. Friedman was somebody, and Stigler was somebody, and there were a few other guys. Anyway, but it's a different way of going. But now, where did Chicago?
So at Notre Dame, I checked ChatGPT, and you're looking at 228
wow.
down chairs.
That's way up from when I was there. Well, that's good for them.
Oh, yeah.
Good for them.
Yep. But my point is, it's a very popular way of donating money. When you make a donation to an institution, most donations have some strings attached to it. So when we're thinking, getting unrestricted funds that you can do anything with is very challenging. But this idea that in an endowed chair, you're going to be supporting this type of research, you're going to be supporting this type of professor, whatever your strings are put into it. And that's one of the reasons why getting an endowed chair is such a big deal. Because the university is recognizing you as somebody who's capable of fulfilling the requirements for those funds.
Well, if I ever was in a position to give Purdue $50 million, I'd sure want a string attached.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
I mean, just here it is, do what you want with it. I'd want to endow you, I'd want to endow something, I'd want to have a building with my name, I want something.
Exactly, and that's why there's a difference between restricted and unrestricted funds, and the larger the donation, the more restricted the funds are traditionally.
So I guess I'll bring you back a little bit. I mean, it seems like we're all over the place, but we're not. It's all kind of the same economic background, everything we're talking about. What do you see the next? Okay, Congress is back together. What do you suppose happens? We talk a lot about this medical care stuff, and we have people that are, you know, guys like Carl are really into it. And it seems to me that on one side of the aisle, you want to continue to fund something that's sort of too expensive and you're going broke doing it. And the other side of the aisle just said, well, we're not going to fund it and we don't know any of the people that are dying. We don't care. Well, either one of those, I mean, it seems like, is anybody going to have the stones enough to go after the medical community and the prescription community and actually drive these prices down? I mean, is anybody ever going to be able to accomplish that?
I don't know. I would like to see. So I let me back up. I believe in free markets, but you can't have your population die. Like, you have to support the population. You have to really be there and provide for people who can't. Particularly when you're looking at an elderly population, these are not people who can go out and get another job,
right?
And you access funding, right? It's just, it's not realistic. You know, there are some jobs for retirees, but if you become a Walmart greeter, that might not be enough to be able to cover your prescription, your cost for prescriptions. And that's something fundamentally wrong with the system. And I don't know a good solution for that.
Well, you know, it's interesting, people's different backgrounds. You look at whether the person can afford it. Now, me, being the knothead that I am, I immediately look to, okay, you just sold this guy this pill for $10. What did it cost you to make? Oh, right. 30 cents? Well, that's interesting. How do you get to do that? I mean, when you say you're a purveyor of the free market, well, so am I. I spent 20 years on the trading floor. If ever there was a free market, that was it.
Right.
I'm going to guess that the brilliant Dr. Demiak, if I were to ask you to name every business now that is still not totally but somewhat competitive, I'll bet you don't need your toes. You just can use your fingers.
Oh, are you talking about, I talk about perfect markets and free markets, I only really focus on the commodities market.
Yeah. I mean, I'd add barbershops. I might even add bars. I might even add in some areas food stores, because there's a zillion of them around here. I'm gonna run out. I don't need my toes. I can do it on the fingers.
I would make the argument that food stores, it depends on your geographical location.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Because there are a lot of other locations where there are genuine food deserts.
Absolutely. I agree. I'm just saying I was struggling. I'm going to struggle to get to 10. But when you look
at... Oh, yeah. No. And the other one I came up with, and this is a really silly one, tchotchke stores. So if you go to, like, Washington, D.C., and you're walking up and down the mall, you'll see these booths set up, and they're all essentially selling the same T-shirt for the same price. And they're weirdly the same T-shirt that you're looking at over and over again. And that was the other example I could use and come up with, because you're looking for uniform products at essentially the same price for a perfect competition. Otherwise, I can't see where it really exists.
I actually would put oil in that camp.
Okay. Well, what about, it's because of the Olga, the competition, or the way that they're structured and their partnerships with each other.
I'm not striving for perfect here. I'm getting something pretty close. I mean, there's 21 countries that export oil.
Why I'm using that expression, it's a very specific situation in economics. We were thinking about perfect competition. And to have a perfectly competitive market, you need a uniform product and you need a same price, and there can't be decisions made amongst all of the competitors.
Right.
We can't get together and conclude together and say, okay, we're going to set the price at this. And that's one of the reasons why it's making the argument that oil wouldn't be there. Because, again, from an economic standpoint, perfect competition is a very specific thing.
Professor, I did say almost.
Almost.
but yeah, I mean, you're right. If Russell's corn farm, if he gets pissed off and decides not to plant that year, it doesn't affect the corn price.
Right.
It's, I mean, he has no. It, I guess it probably does at the 15th decimal, you know, but who cares? I mean, it's, but I mean, in terms of, I mean, you really, I don't see how you can have, and again, I have this railroad background. We have a whole history of, okay, put in the railroad. And we're going to give somebody land to do the railroad. Well, there's no competition or highways back then. So Larissa's grandfather says, hey, can you get my corn to market? The railroad says, yeah, how much do you need? How much you got? You know, I mean, you can't, and we ended up with a whole, what was it, the ICC to regulate prices on railroads, because once you give somebody a monopoly, you can't just let them go wild. Yet we managed to do that with drug patents. Okay, you've got this new drug that's going to cure something, maybe. How much does it cost you to make? Well, what do you mean? What about all this research? What about my salary? No. How much does it cost you to make? Nobody ever asks that question. Nobody ever says, the pill cost me $1. What are you selling it for? 50. Okay, how do you get to do that? Well, we're doing all this other research. Whoa. How do you have an entire industry that is essentially given monopolies by people with no restrictions whatsoever? And yet we've never done that before. We did it to railroads. We did it to airlines. I mean, we always had some sort of, when you give somebody a monopoly, there's some string on you. And how is it in the medical community? We don't seem to have any.
And I think part of it is their ability to make the argument that it just costs so much money to make or do the research.
Bullshit.
Pardon me?
Bullshit. I was like, bull. You and I know that's bull.
Oh, I know. You're asking a
you're
question.
Right. That is the argument, right?
That's the argument that they make. And because they make that argument, they have been able to utilize that and apply it. And it's worked for them. And they, the pharmacy companies, or not the pharmacy, the drug manufacturers, they see no reason to change this.
Well, why would you if you were them?
Absolutely.
What do you think about, now you're educating a lot of younger people, and I'm guessing doing a pretty damn good job. What happens when you send out a letter to your old people and tell you the inflation rate is 2.6%, that's your raise next year in Social Security. But by the way, your Medicare Part B, that's part of the check, goes up 11.3%, and people don't grab a sandwich sign and go walk into Washington tomorrow. How do you get that by people?
Well, it's a topic that we're starting to talk about. I'm teaching a class called Retirement this fall. And we're talking about the cost of medications, and we're talking about the impact of what it looks like in retirement. And it's not something that students really necessarily think about. We're talking about the types of assets that you're put in and you've held them until retirement. And we're talking about what it means to have fixed income during this time period. And how the fluctuation of some of those expenditures in retirement can really, really damper and change your quality of life.
Well, without a doubt, it would be tough for you and me to send out a letter that said, for you, the inflation is 2.6, but for me, it's 11.
Right.
I mean, isn't that what you're saying? Pretty much.
Yep.
It's almost funny, isn't it? If it wasn't sad. So what do you got going this week? Are you going? You guys got a game? Are you going?
We don't have a game. I'm looking at the calendar. No game this weekend. I'm not entirely sure what we're going to do yet. I know my sister's going to the Blackhawks game.
Really? Do you guys have a? If I was at Purdue, I would for sure have season tickets for your basketball team.
They're hard to get.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of students go, or just people in the hood?
I think most people in the hood are students or are connected with the university. So most of my neighbors are professors here.
Well, I mean, because for the Irish, there's a pretty good community in South Bend that has season tickets for basketball because they're cheap. And if you go to a baseball game, I'm going to say 80% of the people there, not a big crowd, but there's a lot of people from South Bend, a lot of retired people that go to the baseball games. I mean, it's a...
Sure.
That's why a lot of people love to retire near a college area. because you have all this entertainment pretty much. If you like sports, hell, you know, you can go. I mean, it's that's what Kevin does. He loves it. He goes to basketball. He goes to he's got men's and women's, but he really likes the women's. And he goes because I mean, he's got a better seat, and sure. Plus they're better than the guys, which always makes it better. But you've just moved there. It's your first year there. Are you part of the gang now?
Not yet. It's again difficult to get tickets.
No, I'm saying you're part of the community. The community welcomed you, and it's fun.
There.
Okay.
Yep.
So everything's good with that. You like it. You're happy there, and
I really really do. It's
good for you.
Beautiful neighborhood. There's great hiking. Crime rate is very different than in Chicago. It's really nice.
Speaking of which, the bar in our building downstairs got broken into last week. That's always cool.
Oh goodness.
Yeah, it's pretty close. And my buddy, the guy who's the janitor engineer in the building, he missed him by like 15 minutes. So I'm pretty happy he would have thought it was somebody who's supposed to be there. He'd have walked right in.
Sure, of course.
It would not have been good. Anyway, they loved having you on. Hope I didn't skip too many topics all over the place. But
No, I like talking about the economy, so this is good.
See, now it's your own fault because you can talk on every topic. I don't have to worry if I shift.
Okay.
So don't blame me, blame you. If I didn't think you could talk about something, I wouldn't go there. So there. Anyway, have a great week, and we'll talk to you next week. Maybe Russell as well. Always miss. I like both of you individually. I like you both together. So either way, it's okay by me. SP Futures up 21, NASDAQ Futures up 142. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.